Welcome to EAN Cast, your weekly source for education, research, and updates from the European Academy of Neurology.
Hello and welcome to EAN Cast, Weekly Neurology. My name is Jurgita Valeikienė. I'm an associate professor at Vilnius University Center of Neurology, Lithuania. Today, we are going to be talking to you about the latest research on cerebrovascular risk factors and the multimodal assessment of carotid plaques at risk. We will introduce a new stroke risk classification system known as carotid plaque RADS and how it can be applied using different imaging modalities such as ultrasound, computed tomography, and magnetic resonance imaging, and how to identify high-risk patients in order to prevent ischemic stroke. My guest today is Kristina Duka. She is a neurologist and neurosonologist at Hospital Pedro Hispano, Matosinhos Local Health Unit, Portugal. Welcome, Kristina, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jurgita. It's a real pleasure to be here and to talk about this very relevant subject.
As we all know, cardiovascular diseases are the leading cause of death and disability, mainly due to heart attack and stroke. According to the latest data, the incidence of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease has increased and is recognized as a leading determinant of overall prognosis. Let's begin our talk with the terms and definition. Which atherosclerotic plaques are considered plaques at risk? And what does it mean for the cardiovascular risk patient? To be more specific, what actually makes a plaque dangerous beyond how much it narrows the artery? What structural features define vulnerability and how do they link to the risk of stroke?
Yeah, that's a really great question. So the essential idea is that most carotid strokes are not caused by the artery simply being too narrow. So they are caused by embolism. A plaque becomes dangerous when its surface ruptures, thrombus forms on it, and material embolizes to the brain or the eye. So that tendency to rupture has surprisingly little to do with the degree of stenosis. And as you said, the structural features that will define vulnerability are well described. We know that they are as a large lipid-rich necrotic core, a thin or ruptured fibrous cap, intraplaque hemorrhage, and also intraplaque neovascularization. This means that there is ingrowth of fragile new vessels from the little vasovasorum that leak and bleed. So we can add also the outward or positive remodeling, where the plaque grows outward rather than into the lumen. So it can stay angiographically almost hidden while becoming biologically dangerous. And from data we know, and specifically from this statement of the vulnerable plaque to vulnerable patient, this concept has shifted. And this shift has been that we move from thinking about a percentage of narrowing to thinking about the biology of the plaque and ultimately also the risk profile of the whole patient. So we will say that a plaque at risk would be an unstable, embologenic, lipid-rich plaque. And of course, identifying it matters because that is the patient in whom we can intervene to prevent a first or a recurrent stroke.
Thank you. Are the location, size, and number of carotid plaques also important in evaluating the atherosclerosis at risk? How does the location of the stenosis differ between Caucasians and Asians? And how, when, who can detect and accurately evaluate high-risk plaques and monitor them, applying appropriate treatment for their stabilization?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course, the burden matters, not just the singlest tightest lesion. And this concept of a carotid plaque score, where we sum plaque across multiple segments and on both sides, will reflect this local atherosclerotic load. And that total burden is itself predictive of vascular events, independent of any one stenosis. So counting and measuring plaques and following them over time gives information that the single stenosis percentage does not. And as you said, the location differs very significantly between populations, and this is very relevant for our clinical practice. So in Caucasians, atherosclerosis is predominantly extracranial, so in the carotid bifurcation and in the proximal internal carotid. In East Asian populations, intracranial disease is far more common. It will affect the distal ICA and the middle cerebral artery. And this has direct consequences for us as neurosonologists. So a cervical duplex study that is entirely normal will not exclude significant intracranial atherosclerosis. And so in patients of a specific background and in the study of the cerebrovascular risk, we need this lower threshold to study intracranial vessels with transcranial Doppler. And this is also part of why conditions like Moyamoya, which is, as we know, an intracranial steno-occlusive disease, will enter the differential more prominently in these populations. And when we think about when or who should perform these exams, this will be, of course, ideally done by a trained neurosonologist, ideally, again, with a high-resolution ultrasound system, and in a lab with quality standards. The reality is that duplex is used widely. It's widely available. With proper training, the detection of plaque and gross characterization can be performed quite broadly. And this is exactly the monitoring is where ultrasound excels, because it is repeatable, it's non-invasive, so we can actually follow this plaque over time and escalate treatment if it progresses or if we find new high-risk features.
I totally agree with you. You mentioned age when talking about the risk factors for atherosclerosis young and old. What can we find by performing cervical duplex ultrasound in younger patients?
Yes, age is very important. It changes what we call the pretest probability enormously. If we think about the younger patients, if we find alterations in the Doppler ultrasound, we have to interrogate if it's truly atherosclerosis, because we can see on ultrasound several non-atherosclerotic causes that are more common in young people that will have distinctive signatures. To say, for example, of course, carotid dissection will produce a mural hematoma with a tapering lumen. Sometimes we can see a flap. If we see fibromuscular dysplasia, it can give this beaded appearance, mostly in the mid to distal ICA. Carotid web, that it's more and more recognized, itself a variant of the fibromuscular dysplasia considered, will appear as a thin shelf, a projection in the posterior wall of the bulb. And this will be a very important cause of a cryptogenic stroke in young. Of course, if the disease is intracranial and progressive, we have to consider Moyamoya. And so in older patients, of course, the overwhelming likelihood would be atherosclerosis. And we know from ancillary studies, from the Rotterdam study and others, that age, hypertension, and smoking will drive, of course, this prevalence of carotid disease and this progression at a population level.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. You already mentioned that patients with vulnerable plaques were described as vulnerable, and at first it was made for coronary arteries. It was pointed out that these plaques may contribute to converting chronic coronary atherosclerosis to acute coronary artery disease. And in recent years, Coronary Artery Disease Reporting and Data System, CADRS, was developed to standardize the reporting of coronary CTA. What is a newly introduced carotid plaque RES? How are the categories structured? and what does it add? Would it be applicable in everyday clinical practice in addition to stenosis grading by NASCET? Is PLECRS ready to guide intervention decisions, or perhaps it is still a research and stratification tool?
That's very important to discuss, because this parallel with the CAD-RADS is exactly the right way in cardiology. Recognize that this writing freely in non-CTA reports would lead to inconsistencies, so the CAD-RADS standardize these into reproducible categories that, in the end, the most important thing that would guide management. So we know now that there has been established the carotid plaques RADS that applies the same philosophy but to the carotid plaque. So it runs from category 1 to 5, being 1 with no plaque. Category 2 would be a predominantly stable plaque. We go to 3, that will be mixed. 4, it's going to be a more unstable plaque with more lipid-rich components, but without this surface disruption. And this final 5th category, where it's the higher risk plaques that are complex, that have ulceration, hemorrhage, or other of these high risk features that we can access through Doppler ultrasound. And another very important aspect is that this categorization is designed to work across modalities, ultrasound, CT, and MRI, to the point that the same language will describe the plaque wherever it is or however it is imaged. What it adds over an asset that we use more for quantification is a sort of a second axis of information. NASCET, as we know, will tell you how tight the stenosis is, and PLECRS would actually tell you how dangerous this plaque is. And used together, so they should be used together in the sense they will be far more informative than alone, of course, especially in this gray area of the moderate stenosis. I think that currently it is not yet a decision maker for surgery or stenting the PLECRS. We really do lack these prospective trials that will show that category alone should decide intervention or no. So it's a powerful stratification and research tool, and it's really a structured way to feed this vulnerable plaque concept into the clinical decision, of course, alongside symptoms and stenosis.
That's interesting. Are you already using carotid plaque RADS in your hospital? I would like to ask, and could the lack of time, lack of experienced sonographers, or lack of high-resolution ultrasound systems negatively influence the implementation of carotid plaque RADS into clinical practice? How do you think?
Yeah, we are beginning to apply these principles. So doing this systematic plaque characterization and try to do a structured description. I think that for most centers, including ours, is that it's still being integrated rather than already fully embedded. I think the barriers you name are exactly the important one. Time, a proper plaque characterization, will take, of course, longer than simply reporting a velocity and a percentage. So we all know we work all in busy labs where time pressure is really significant. So this would be one limitation. The other one, which is transversal to all the neurosonology field, is that expertise is very important. So reproducible plaque classification will require trained, experienced sonographers. This variability between observers is a genuine limitation without the training, and even sometimes in very trained specialists. And we need good equipment. We need a machine that can assess surface features and this fine morphology that requires high resolution systems. And which is very important, also the contrast capability, so the possibility to do contrast enhanced ultrasound to check for neovascularization. Not every center will have this ability. I think that none of these limitations is impossible to overcome, but they mean that this adoption probably be gradual, will depend on training programs, and of course on the results of studies that prove that this effort really changes outcomes.
Thank you. Would you like to point out how do CT angiography, MRI, and digital subtract angiography compare for vulnerable plaque imaging? How would you compare these imaging modalities?
When we use the B-mode using ultrasound, we know that it's a really high temporal resolution. It's in real time. It's widely available. It doesn't have a radiation. And it is really good at echogenicity, so distinguishing this echolucent, lipid-rich, more dangerous plaque from echogenic and calcified. For surface details and for ulceration would be harder to check. And of course, we know that if there's a calcification, we can have an acoustic shadow that will difficult our assessment. When we use this contrast ultrasound, we'll have something that B-mode can't. So we use microbubbles that penetrate the plaque, reveal this neovascularization, and this has a strong correlation with intraplaque hemorrhage and this large lipid core. It's not used that common because of this time cost and this need for trained operator. And it's not embedded in guidelines, so it's a selective tool rather than, I would say, a routine one. Maybe we hope that with time this changes. If we think about other modalities that we use to study atherosclerosis and the unstable plaque, we know that CT angiography is fast. Is excellent for calcification, to grade the stenosis, sort of an anatomical roadmap. So the trade-offs would be radiation, the contrast, and sometimes this calcium blooming can obscure the lumen. When we think and know more and more about vessel wall MRI, which will be strongest for composition, will allow us to really study the hemorrhage cap integrity, so to really detailing the plaque characteristics. Not all centers will have this availability, and it's also slower and motion sensitive. And of course, angiography remains the reference for the lumen and hemodynamics. It's invasive, it has a small procedural risk. So of course, we use it only in inconclusive cases or when we are planning intervention. So I would summarize this as ultrasound and contrast as a first line, MRI for the composition, CTA for the map, and angiography for problem solving.
Thank you very much for so detailed explanation. I would like to return to the ICA stenosis grading according to NASCET criteria. Do we need to add ESCT criteria very shortly or not?
I think that the important thing is that we have to report which method are we using and to be consistent because they are not interchangeable. We know that NASCET will compare the lumen to the normal distal ICA. SCST compares it to the estimated original diameter at the level of stenosis. So this means that ECST will overestimate, so a higher number for the same lesion. The trials that we use that set our threshold for intervention use the NASCET methodology. So we have to know this. That would be the standard reporting. And I would not add ECST for its own sake, because it will create a bit of confusion and sometimes over-treatment if the numbers are mixed. And I think that we have to be able to convert it and know how to interpret it and be consistent.
You are right. In your opinion, what is the difference between a standard carotid ultrasound versus point-of-care ultrasound or POCUS? And what questions could POCUS answer in symptomatic patients in the emergency department, ICU, or ambulatory room? And could it change the management of stroke patients, talking about carotid artery stenosis and plaques, and stable plaques?
Yes, POCUS ultrasound, it's very important that we talk about this and reflect on this, because the difference is really one of scope and question. When we do, of course, a standardized or carotid ultrasound, would be comprehensive, bilateral, systematic, ideally in acute stroke patient to study intracranial vessels as well. But and we are doing full stenosis quantification, and POCUS is focused. So we are asking a specific time critical question at the bedside. So, for example, in a symptomatic patient in the emergency department or in the ICU, the question is there a culprit lesion ipsilateral to the symptoms that changes what I will do in the next hour? A significant ipsilateral plaque, a near occlusion, an occlusion, a dissection. These findings will generally change management in the sense that we will decide on the urgency of definite imaging, the treatment options, and if this patient needs an urgent vascular assessment. And of course, after amaurosis fugaz in a TIA, in an outpatient setting, a focused look at the ipsilateral carotid will rapidly confirm our suspicion of a significant symptomatic stenosis that in the end will set the pace of the workup. And I think that what a non-specialist can reliably do in a few minutes is assess the presence and size of this of a significant plaque, a gross morphological category, a peak velocity estimate that can flag a significant stenosis, and the color flow that will spot obvious occlusion. What they cannot do will be grade the stenosis or characterize the surface for alteration, detect a web or exclude dissection. So this will be more a bit more specialized. POCUS is a triage. It guides urgency. It will not replace a formal study. And I think that knowing that boundary is what makes it safe and very useful.
Yes, that's very important. Thank you. Sometimes performing POCUS, we can detect microembolic signals. Have you done that already or not? Several microembolic signals may signalize about pathophysiology of stroke. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's another high-risk feature of any plaque, and we know from previous studies that it can even help us to guide our decision on the antiplatelet regimen. So, of course, if we are able to do the study of microembolic signals, the spontaneous one, in an acute setting and even during the stroke unit admittance, it will be very important to guide our decision and to characterize a bit more the risk, the embolic risk of that patient. Of course, we can see microembolic signals not only from plaques, but they can only come from carotid plaques. They can come from the heart or from the aorta. So it can help us and guide this initial study.
Yes, yes, exactly. Neurologist with cerebrovascular anatomy knowledge baggage has a privilege to know where to look at when using target ultrasound according to the presented neurological symptoms and signs, as you mentioned. Would we teach the non-neurologists how to do that? What do you think?
I think we can. I think we we must. And of course, there are many, at least in my context, many internal medicine doctors that act as the primary line in care also for stroke patients. The neurologist advantage is exactly how he describes. So it's symptom driven. We do a hypothesis led scanning. We localize from these clinical pictures. So we know which vessel and which territory to study. And that clinical reasoning is teachable, I think, with a structured curriculum, with defined competencies, a clear understanding of this focus protocols and cerebrovascular anatomy. So I think that general focus training will teach people to operate the machine. And I think that dedicated neuro-oriented focus with proper orientation would be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. That's so important. And how do you see the future of ultrasound diagnostic and stroke management? What will be most change? How we stratify carotid stroke risk in the next few years? And what's about using AI?
Mm-hmm. I think that on one hand, I think this we should really converge this standardized reporting, and I think that AI will have a role in this, of course, because as we said before, the main limitation of plaque characterization is inter-observer variability. So even two skilled readers can classify the same plaque differently, and that can undermine any risk system. So maybe this AI analysis trained on histologically validated data can make that assessment reproducible and quantitative in real time, directly even from the B-mode imaging. If we combine this with the enhancement using using contrast for neovascularization, and also with this standardized reporting framework, we will move from a largely qualitative exercise towards something that it's reproducible, a risk score that's repeatable, and that allows us to set up, of course, other big studies, longitudinal studies. And in the end, this will lead us to identify the truly vulnerable patient and not just the vulnerable plaque. So again, through large, multi-center, multimodal research with also comparison with other MRI vessel imaging events, and also PET scans can prove the value and cost effectiveness before this will eventually reach into routine guidelines.
Thank you, Kristina, for so interesting talk. And now it's time to summarize our talk. Carotid plaques at risk are unstable, embologenic, lipid-rich atherosclerotic plaques characterized by a thin fibrous gap prone to rupture, intraplaque hemorrhage, intraplaque neovascularization, and outward remodeling. It may remain angiographically silent, however dangerous due to a possible local thrombosuperposition and arterial embolization to the brain and eye, causing acute ischemic stroke. And they present a standardized evaluation of carotid plaques using a new stroke risk classification system, carotid plaque RESS, could help accurately identify patients at risk of TIA or stroke, as Kristina told us. It is recommended to grade the stenosis according to NASES criteria, and in addition, try to apply the standardized carotid plaque RESS to optimize medication treatment, and if indicated, to perform appropriate endovascular treatment in a timely manner before a stroke occurs. And non-invasive cervical color-coded duplex ultrasonography with or without contrast agent is recommended for the detection, assessment, and monitoring of carotid plaques at risk. And furthermore, as Kristina told us, larger multicentral research on vulnerable carotid plaques, including ultrasound and IIA-assisted plaque analysis, is needed to demonstrate the importance of POCUS and standard neurosymbiological examination for their integration into cerebrovascular disease prevention and stroke guidelines. Christina, would you like to add something for this summarizing?
I think this you summarize it pretty well, and I think it's important that we use Doppler not only in the lab for our patients in the not only in the stroke unit but in the emergency room, in outpatient clinics. So I think it really is a tool that has to be at all times present in our care for our stroke patients, and it can allow us to really individualize treatment and the follow-up and prevent the new stroke.
Christina, thank you for your wonderful, informative talk. And now we should thank our listeners and say goodbye.
This has been EAN Cast Weekly Neurology. Thank you for listening. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your preferred podcatcher for weekly updates from the European Academy of Neurology. You can also listen to this and all of our previous episodes on the EAN campus to gain points and become an EAN expert in any of our 29 neurological specialties. Simply become an EAN individual member to gain access. For more information, visit ean.org/membership. That's ean.org/membership. Thanks for listening. EAN Cast Weekly Neurology is your unbiased and independent source for educational and research-related neurological content. Although all content is provided by experts in their field, it should not be considered official medical advice.